21-18-24, United States of America versus Damari LaPaul Thomas Matthews. Oral argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Supervisory attorney Ms. Melissa Salinas introduces and will be arguing today. First, law student Alex Nerona. Second, law student Anna Schuver. For the defendant appellant.
Thank you. May it please the court. I'm here to as counsel of record for Mr. Thomas Matthews, and I would like to thank the court for allowing the student attorneys to argue the case. I will be here to supervise them. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Alex Nerona. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Fine.
The fundamental issue underlying this appeal is that during sentencing, the district judge failed, both procedurally and substantively, to conduct a fair, thorough, and context-informed assessment of the individualized circumstances relating to Mr. Thomas Matthews and his offenses. Given our limited time today, I plan to discuss two procedural errors relating to the district court's application of the 18-to-1 crack-to-powder cocaine ratio, and my colleague, Ms. Schuver, plans to discuss the district court's deficient consideration of Mr. Thomas Matthews' relevant history and characteristics under Section 3553A. First, the district court impermissibly treated the crack-to-powder ratio in the advisory sentencing guidelines as effectively mandatory. This is procedural error under the Supreme Court's decisions in Kimbrough and Spears. The district court's exact words are very important. When explaining his denial of Mr. Thomas Matthews' motion to vary downward to a 1-to-1 ratio, the judge stated, quote, "Congress is the one who passes the statutes of this nature, or the Guidelines Commission revisits the guidelines and submits guidelines with a 1-to-1 ratio. That is the proper way to, in the court's judgment, to deal with this particular issue," end quote.
Wasn't he talking at that point about the what looked like a conflict in his mind between the executive branch and Congress? But what he also noted was, look, I don't have a problem with the policy. I mean, I think he says that twice, that it's, I don't have a, the court at present time has no policy dispute regarding the contours of the guideline. And he says, I'm going to decline the invitation because the court has no policy dispute. So, I mean, isn't that take care of it? He doesn't have a policy dispute. He's okay with it.
Yes, Your Honor. A judge is allowed to agree or disagree with the advisory 18-to-1 ratio as a matter of policy. And as Your Honor noted, the judge did say that. But what a judge cannot do is agree with the advisory ratio for reasons that Kimbrough rejected. And those reasons include congressional deference as well as institutional competence. The other issue here is that the judge never engaged with the substance of the litigant's policy argument. He merely said, I have no policy dispute, and that was it. There was nothing more. There was no engaging with the substance of the scientific and policy arguments.
Does that mean that judge is required to have an opinion about the underlying policy? If a judge doesn't have an opinion and wants to defer to Congress for that reason, he's not allowed to do that?
So the judge may have an opinion about the policy, but those opinions must not be rooted in the reasons that Kimbrough rejected, which are congressional deference and institutional competence. I would also like to point Your Honor to the Camper case, where this court held that if a district court is confronted with an argument that the guidelines range is flawed, as here, the court, quote, must confront the merits of any scientific or policy-based arguments and articulate its reasons for rejecting such arguments, end quote. And
but isn't this district judge pretty much saying, that he thinks this 18-to-1 ratio is fine?
The judge,
if he says that, what are we supposed to do with that?
That would be fine, but he did not explain the affirmative reasons for why that would be fine. And that's how this case is distinguishable from both Camper as well as the, I believe it's the Thomas case, where the judges there expressed affirmative reasons for why they thought the ratio that was appropriate, and those reasons were not reasons that Kimbrough rejected, such as deference to Congress. Here, reading the sentencing transcript, the judge was clearly influenced by deference to Congress, and even though we acknowledge, he said, I have no policy dispute, but that was the end of that. He didn't explain why he had no policy dispute. He didn't engage with the substantive arguments. And I'll also note that in this particular case, the Department of Justice itself also held the position that the 18-to-1 ratio was flawed as a matter of policy, in addition to Mr. Thomas Matthews himself. And as this court held in its published decision in Camper, the judge was required to engage with the merits of those arguments, and he simply did not do that here.
So this very same district judge was involved in the two Johnson cases?
I believe, Your Honor, you are correct as to Kenneth Johnson. I'm not 100% sure.
There are two Kenneth Johnson cases.
Oh, okay.
And in one, and I happen to be on them, so I paid particular attention to them. In the first one, we said that this particular district judge was not following Kimbrough and remanded so that the district judge could confront the policy arguments. And then in the second one, arguably, we upheld, we said that the district judge must not rely on the guidelines for reasons that Kimbrough rejected. That's in the 2010 Johnson case. So don't you think that this suggests that this district judge was attempting to follow our guidance in the two prior cases?
So, Your Honor, and this goes to another issue that I'm happy to talk about in a little bit more detail, which is reassignment, where we have concerns that this judge was provided specific instructions by this court about not following using reasons that Kimbrough rejected, such as congressional deference or institutional competence, as reasons for following the 18-to-1 ratio in the guidelines, and yet here we are, you know, over a decade later, and it appears that the exact same thing is happening, and that's one of our concerns.
Is there any special reason with respect to your client why the 18-to-1 ratio is not appropriate?
Yes, so that goes to like our second procedural argument, which is that the judge never responded directly to the second argument that was made, that is, in the specific circumstances of this case, it would be inappropriate. So Mr. Thomas Matthews also pled guilty to two 924C counts, which resulted in a 10-year mandatory minimum sentence. So one of the arguments that his counsel provided during sentencing was that considering that 10-year mandatory minimum, on top of that applying the 18-to-1 ratio, would result in an excessively long sentence. And so that was the reason, and we'll note that that wasn't responded to.
And especially for your client because of that mandatory minimum on the two other counts that mandatorily gave him 10 years.
Exactly. Thank you, Your Honor.
Your Honors, and may it please the Court, my name is Annie Schuver. I'll be addressing the issues relating to the District Court's failure to address Mr. Thomas Matthews' relevant history and characteristics. Just as the District Court failed to give an individualized assessment about the appropriate crack-to-powder ratio in this particular case, The court also failed to individualize its assessment of the 3553A factors, in particular with regard to Mr. Thomas Matthews' history and characteristics. At sentencing, Mr. Thomas Matthews spent a significant amount of time articulating mitigating personal history. The extreme and traumatic conditions he faced during his childhood were not garden variety hardships. He explained that he was, quote, physically and sexually abused from infancy up to the fifth grade, which is when his first juvenile conviction occurred. He also explained that his childhood home was rowdy.
But the district court acknowledged that, didn't he? He said, I fully recognize the defendant's eloquent allocution statement here. He's taking responsibility for his conduct. I mean, he acknowledged all of it. He goes through, I view the defendant as a risk to the law-abiding public. I mean, it looks to me like the district court is talking about the defendant, his characteristics. He listened to what he had to say. The court recited all the 3553A factors. I mean, isn't that enough under our case law? I mean, it's probably more than what we've seen in some cases.
No, Your Honor. So this court's decision in Thomas makes clear that conclusory statements are not enough to respond to a defendant's non-frivolous arguments. And the statements that you referred to of the district courts don't go to Mr. Thomas Matthews' history and characteristics. The explanations that Mr. Thomas Matthews provided were highly detailed, very individualized, and personal. But the district court's response to that was, quote, I've considered all of the defendant's arguments. That statement could apply to any defendant who's ever raised an argument in court.
At the present time, I view the defendant as a risk to the law-abiding public. He needs to be specifically deterred. I mean, that's very specific to this guy. I mean, that's not a general statement that could apply to every defendant, right?
So the issue with that statement, Your Honor, is that it doesn't respond to Mr. Thomas Matthews' non-frivolous arguments, and that in itself is a reversible error. In this court's decisions in Buffington, Temple, and, as I mentioned before, Thomas, the court reversed and remanded sentences where there was a failure to explain the court's reasons for rejecting a non-frivolous argument. The court must provide enough to set forth, enough to satisfy the appellate court that the judge has considered the party's arguments and has a reasoned basis for the decision. Furthermore, while a district court, of course, is not always required to have lengthy discussions, in this particular case, the reason why the district court needed to explain more is because there was nothing in the record to suggest that the court had actually considered and rejected Mr. Thomas Matthews' arguments.
Do you agree that this particular issue and your co-counsel, his second issue, those are both plain error review here because there should have been something said at the Bostic question, right? You didn't adequately consider the arguments that I just made.
Your Honor, our briefs articulate two separate reasons why we believe abuse of discretion review should apply. One of those is because the substantive and procedural issues overlap here. And the other reason is because although there wasn't a specific objection post the Bostock question, these issues were extensively litigated prior to and during the sentencing hearing.
Well, you can't litigate whether the judge explained something at the sentencing hearing before the sentencing hearing, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. But Mr. Thomas Matthews also couldn't object to the reasonableness of his sentence at that time either. That would be something only the appellate court could consider. So I'd like to move back to the reason why more explanation was required in response to Mr. Thomas Matthews' argument. There was no context in the record, like there was in Rita and Gunter, to show that the court had actually considered these arguments. There was no summarization of the arguments. There was no back and forth with counsel or Mr. Thomas Matthews about his history and characteristics. There were no other hearings where these factors were discussed. So there was nothing in the record to show whether the district court completely forgot these arguments or whether it considered them at all. I see my time has elapsed, so if there are no further questions, thank you.
Thank you.
Patrick Castle for the United States. May it please the court. The defendant appellant, Mr. Thomas Matthews, is a confessed repeated armed drug dealer. During one 6-month period, he committed six crimes, three of which he pled guilty to in this case. He pled guilty to two crimes of carrying a firearm in support of drug dealing and one crime of drug dealing. And for each of those three crimes, he received a 60-month sentence. Only one of those sentences is at issue here on appeal, and the district court's imposition of that sentence was reasonable and should be upheld. First, it was procedurally reasonable because the district court acknowledged on the record multiple times in the transcript its own authority to either impose the 18...
What do we do about this reference to Congress? I mean, that seems pretty close to some statements that we've said are out of, like, suggest that the that's the wrong focus in terms of the policy argument.
I think
Johnson,
Your Honor's...
The Van de Weg, whatever that case is, or a couple others.
I think Your Honor's question to appellant counsel hit the nail on the head. The problem is that when you look at that out of context, you miss the fact that the court first addressed its own policy dispute and said the court has no policy dispute with the present ratio. There was a separate issue, however, because both parties had alerted the district court to the fact that the Department of Justice has taken a view as a policy matter that Congress should amend the 18-to-1 crack-to-powder ratio.
Well,
and so the court...
Isn't the Department of Justice also arguing that it is appropriate to have a 1-to-1 ratio?
That is my understanding of the department's argument, Your Honor, and that
so how can you defend this district judge saying it's fine with me to have 18-to-1?
Because, Your Honor, the Department of Justice understands that there is a world of difference between the department's view of what the law should be and what the law actually is. We acknowledge that. The department's view is set forth as an attachment to the sentencing memos that are part of the record, and it was submitted to the Senate Judiciary Committee. But the question before this court is, did the district court err in imposing the law as it's written? And the answer is no, because the district court acknowledged it had the discretion to deviate from the policy guidelines ratio and elected not to because the court has no dispute.
Where does the court in its sentencing say, I recognize I have the discretion to depart from the 18-to-1, but I'm choosing not to? Is there a particular language that you point us to?
There are two places, Your Honor, and I'll start with Record 39, page 211. Quote, I also fully recognize my discretion in determining an appropriate sentence as recognized by the United States Supreme Court in its decisions in Booker, Kimbrough, Rita, Gall, Spears, and the Sixth Circuit case of Herrera-Zuniga. As this court knows, Booker, Kimbrough, and Spears together, the significance of those three cases are that the district court is not bound by the guidelines, may deviate from the 18-to-1 ratio, and may do so for purely policy reasons. The court then reiterated on page 212 of the same transcript, as far as the defendant's invitation for the court to utilize a 1-to-1 ratio, the court has no policy dispute with the present ratio. The court declines the invitation. The court did not say this invitation is moot because courts may not make such policy determinations, or this invitation is rejected because the court lacks the power to accept it.
So it's the same district judge as in the Kenneth James Johnson case, two cases.
It is, Your Honor.
Do you feel, how do you address those two cases as applied to this case's situation?
Well, I anticipated the court might ask about this, and I would note that this would be propensity evidence if it was the district court, but I looked into the record to see what the sentence was the third time it went down after the second appeal, and it was 110 months, 80 months. So I think the government's main position is the court did not say in this case what it said in the second Johnson opinion or the first Johnson opinion. The court said that it has no policy dispute with the present ratio, and that's why it was imposing the ratio. But even beside that, to the extent the three Johnson sentencings teach this court anything, is that this district court judge is responsive to this court's opinions, and there is no basis under this court's high standard to assign the case to a different district court judge on remand.
You're saying if there's any judge in the circuit that knows he has the authority to do this, it's this one?
What I'm saying is that to the extent that the Johnson record is being presented,
but isn't the language similar? I guess that's what I'm curious about. And maybe it isn't just the mention of Congress, but it, I mean, it would be odd to keep making the same mistake, I suppose. I don't know, but we've seen it before, so it's not unheard of, but it's close.
Because building on Judge Nalbandian, in the 2010 opinion, this district judge said, I fully recognize my authority to vary from the crack cocaine powder guidelines based solely on a policy disagreement. But then Congress has said, et cetera.
And then went on to say, but these policy considerations are not for the court to make. And it was that statement, not the court's earlier statement, recognizing its authority, that caused this court to say, well, this is a confusing record, because the court has said it has this authority, but later deferred
to
Congress.
You're saying here where he says, I have no policy, I'm making it clear, I have no policy dispute with the present ratio, meaning I'm applying 1-to-1. I don't have a problem with it. Or 18, I'm sorry, I'm applying 18-to-1. I mean, that's what you're saying. That's the difference, you say?
That is the difference, because okay. The basis in this opinion is not deference to Congress or any other branch of government. It's the court's own policy dispute or lack thereof with the guidelines.
To move on then to one of the arguments that your opponent raised, it is that this was not tailored to the particulars of this individual defendant, where he was getting 2 5-year mandatory minimums consecutive, so he's already getting 10 years. And according to your opponent, the 18-to-1 ratio is particularly inappropriate under these circumstances. And did the district judge address that, or should the district judge have addressed that?
Well, Your Honor, the district court judge addressed the 18-to-1 ratio.
In general.
Whether the 18-to-1 ratio should be imposed, that's right. The district court judge addressed the particular circumstances of the appellant's case. And the district court judge stated he needs a sentence within the advisory guideline range. And of course, the other sentences are mandatorily consecutive. There's no question that he realized when he was imposing the sentence that his decision to impose the 18-to-1 ratio as written in the guidelines would result in a total sentence of 60 plus 60 plus whatever he imposed within the guidelines. And I think the suggestion that the court needs to explicitly address every possible permutation of all the different arguments and their various combinations that the appellant raises is not supported by this court's decision in Gunter, and more importantly, by the Supreme Court's decision in Rita, in which the Supreme Court affirmed a district court's decision where it stated that the guidelines range was, quote, not inappropriate, and that the particular sentence within that range was, quote, appropriate. In the Young case, 2 hours of argument were made on whether to deviate from the ratio. And in response, the district court judge, who was affirmed by this court, said, I've listened to all this, and in my view, justice can be served by imposing the ratio, so I will impose the ratio. There's no great speech that's required as long as this court is satisfied that the court has listened to the arguments, has understood the arguments, and has not misunderstood its own authority. In this case, the record shows that the court did that. Appellant raises the Ferguson case. Oh, Your Honor?
Sorry to interrupt, but I seem to recall that there's some law that if there are mandatory minima on other counts, that a district judge should consider that in deciding the sentence for a remaining count. Am I misremembering the law? I wish I could give you a case, but
My understanding of the law in this area is that a district court judge, in imposing a sentence on a count that does not have a mandatory consecutive minimum, is permitted to consider the impact of the mandatory minimum counts in imposing that sentence.
Did this district judge do that, do you think?
I think the record shows that the court did do that. The court's imposition of the within-guideline sentence and the court's statement that an advisory guideline range sentence was necessary is in the same sentence as the court's acknowledgement that that will mean that the sentence for the one non-mandatory count will be coupled with 2 sentences for mandatory minimums.
The count was the firearm possession, right?
The two 924C counts were the mandatory.
Firearms, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And doesn't he say somewhere, like, I've considered the toxic mix between the firearm possession and the, doesn't he do that right after the policy argument? I mean, that suggests to me that he's considering the, he's considering the firearm, the mandatory minimum, the firearm, and the drugs, right? That's the toxic mix.
You're right, Your Honor. That's page 213, quote, we have a toxic mix between possession of firearms and drug trafficking. Also, quote, the circumstances of this particular case are very concerning to the court, end quote.
I mean, does that go to this 18 to 1, or is that something separate about the possession of the firearm or whatever, I guess would be my question.
I think part of appellant's strategy has been to try to pick apart parts of the transcript and say, well, this only goes to this part, or this only goes to this part. But the way that the sentencing was conducted, like the way many sentencings are conducted, it's not so neatly dissected. One side talked and said everything they had to say about all the issues. Then the next side talked and said everything they had to say about all the issues. The defendant spoke. He addressed every issue that he wanted to. And then the district court started to explain the reasons for its sentence. So it's just not, I don't think, a reasonable approach to the viewing this transcript to try to dissect it.
I take it you would argue that this one is plain error. This particular issue would be a plain error review.
I think in particular, the argument that the district court judge failed to acknowledge his own authority should be reviewed for plain error, Your Honor.
Well, isn't that one, that of all the issues, that one to me would be the one that wouldn't be plain error, right? Because that one came up during the briefing. That one was always an issue at the sentencing. It's not an issue about whether he adequately explained himself. Those seem to me to be the plain error ones, right? He didn't take into account the 18 to 1 for this particular defendant. He didn't consider 3553A for this particular defendant. That's Bostic. You got to object. The question about whether he misapprehended his authority, I think didn't Camper say that that's you can preserve that one by raising it during the course of the proceeding beforehand?
You could preserve that by raising your argument that the court has not understood that it does have the authority to make this argument, but nobody made that point to the district court.
No, but they said you have authority to divert yourself from the 18 to 1 guideline, and the DJ says whatever he wants to say. So isn't that fully presented?
I see what you're saying, Your Honor.
There's no need to have a further objection.
As the court knows, the government's view is that plain error review applies to all of these arguments. However, I don't think that the standard of review is dispositive, because for the reasons set forth in the government's brief, whatever the standard of review, there was simply no error here because the court acknowledged on the record that it had the authority, but that it did not have a policy dispute with the guidelines.
What about the argument that this district judge did not address the personal circumstances of the defendant and those had been specifically raised?
I think the question goes to how much under Rita and this court's cases is a district court required to say, because the court did address it. It was raised in the defendant's sentencing memorandum. Defense counsel raised it in his statements to the court. And then the court responded, the court recognizes the defendant's history.
But then the court goes into the criminal history. And that's all that the court talks about there.
Well, that's not what the court says next. The court says there was a period of time after he was discharged where there appears to be minor blips in the road, if none at all. And really, both of those two statements go to the two arguments the defendant appellant made, which was, first, that he had a difficult childhood, and second, that after some periods of incarceration for other drug-related crimes, he had a period where he was engaging in pro-social activities. I think he started a barber shop and he built a relationship with his children.
But this doesn't address his difficult childhood at all.
The court recognizes the defendant's history, and that statement is made after defense counsel made his arguments, which included arguments about his life history, his childhood, and then also later his success after some initial periods of incarceration. So the court did acknowledge that these arguments were made. They were in the briefing that the court stated it had read. I see that my time's up. Your Honor.
So what you're saying is that judge doesn't have to discuss these history and characteristics of the defendant as long as he acknowledges or states that he's aware of them. Is that what you're saying?
I think it's important. May I answer this question?
Oh, yes.
I think it's important for the court to explain the enough for the defendant and the public to understand that he has reviewed the arguments, and for the public and the defendant to understand what are the particular factors that are animating the sentence. And here those factors were overwhelmingly the defendant's concerning criminal conduct, deterrence of the public, and safety of the community. And the court made that clear on this record. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
I would like to respond to three primary issues raised in the government's argument. First, we fully acknowledge that the district judge stated that he recognized his discretion. But under this court's precedence, simply saying certain words is insufficient to establish that a judge in fact recognized their discretion to reject the guidelines ratio. And in Kenneth Johnson, this court vacated and remanded despite the judge's explicit statement that, quote, "I fully recognize my authority to vary from the crack powder cocaine guidelines," end quote. That's a nearly identical statement to the one that the judge made below. However, in Kenneth Johnson, this court reviewed the whole record and held that the judge improperly ceded his discretion despite those inconsistent findings about his own authority. I'd also direct this court to the Camper case, where very similar facts were at play as well. I'll also note that, again, we acknowledge that the judge did say, "I have no policy dispute." However, in Camper, this court held that if a district court is confronted with an argument, which Mr. Thomas Matthews made, that court must, quote, must confront the merits of any scientific or policy-based arguments and articulate its reasons for rejecting such arguments. The judge below did not do that here. I'll also note, moving to my second point, that the district court failed to consider or respond to Mr. Thomas Matthews' Booker and Section 3553A argument. The sentencing transcript is clear here. The district court addressed Mr. Thomas Matthews' first argument about a categorical rejection of the 18-to-1 ratio, but never addressed, or frankly, didn't even acknowledge the second, more case-specific argument that was raised by defense counsel that the 18-to-1 ratio should be considered in light of the consecutive 10-year mandatory minimum for the two 924C counts. And that, in aggregate, would create an excessively long sentence. And that was never responded to by this judge. Which moves me to my third and final rebuttal point, which is on standard review. As Your Honor mentioned, the Camper case does hold that failure to recognize discretion is reviewed for abuse of discretion. However, I will also note that to the extent that this court, for the failure to consider and failure to explain arguments, believes that the appropriate standard of review is plain error, I'll emphasize that for those claims, this court has reversed under plain error review in the Wallace case, in the Michael Johnson case, and in the McAllister case, specifically because failing to consider or explain precludes meaningful appellate review, which is a substantial right. And so we believe that those three cases indicate that this court should reverse, even under plain error, for the failure to consider or failure to explain procedural claims. This court should vacate and remand for resentencing before a new district judge. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both, all three of you, for the argument. And in particular, I want to thank the University of Michigan for its representation of its client. You have done an excellent job, and we see a lot of lawyers over time, and your client is lucky to have excellent lawyers such as yourself representing him. So we thank the United States for its argument as well. But it's always a pleasure to have students from the University of Michigan doing the argument. So thank you very much. And the clerk may adjourn court.